Hi, everybody, and welcome to our Dissipation of Glamour Initiative webinar. I guess it's number 18, unless I'm mistaken, and we're rolling along, working through the Glamour World Problem book. It's a wonderful book, and as you probably know, excuse me, these were instructions that Master DK gave to his group of nine that he were being trained as a seed group for trained observers. So I guess we are all attempting to do something of that nature in a world which is distressed because of the veiling of truth and reality caused by glamour and illusion. Just want to, you know, whoever's here, want to welcome you, Alex, Annette, Antoinette, Clesia, Dacia, Deborah, and Inez, and Yoke, and Karen, Catherine, Lori, Martha, Michael, Olivia, Paul, Suzanne, Tanya, Winnie, and Zach, and of course, on staff we have Joe and Brett and myself to take care of all problems of a technical nature which may arise. Well, we'll follow our standard procedure, which is to have just a little alignment and then a reading from Glamour, A World Problem. And then opportunity for statements, questions, reflections, either on tonight's material. I say tonight because here in Finland it is that. This time we're broadcasting from the Temple of Silence and not from the Little Bear Meditation Center. We've come down to the south, you know, and hopefully all will be clear. And then we will have our meditation on the dissipation of world glamour, and we're working especially on, at this time, hatred and separativeness. You know, the one great heresy we've been told, the one great fallacy of thought, the one great illusion veiling truth is separateness. There is no such thing, but the limited human consciousness perceives in that manner at the present time, usually, and we have to learn how to overcome that. So, in the beginning, yes, and you know, I've welcomed you all, but you know, some people will be joining us, so welcome to you too. And we are together in different continents, different countries, and coming into a community of soul relation. If not on the higher mental plane, then at least our mind should be influenced by the light of the soul, or the soul which is light, that light coming from the higher mental plane. And we should increasingly be able to form a group organism which has the purpose of destroying or dissipating at least some of the veils on the astral plane which prevent the registration of truth. And you know, according to the Tibetan, we all have these veils, and they are of very long standing. Perhaps if we were an initiate of the fourth degree and ready to focus on the Buddhic plane, the plane of pure intuition, then the usual veils would have been dissipated, but you know, there are veils that that blind the striving initiate even before the sixth degree, and a great veil before the ninth degree, and it's just incredible, you know, the veils are ever subtler, but they are veils upon reality. Well, we couldn't stand to see reality as it really is, you know. The old saying, no one can see the face of God and live, at least in the form in which the seeing takes place. And even on a lesser scale, It's not until the fifth degree that we can see Sanat Kumara face to face. Otherwise, it would just be too much. So there's a veil called a star, and there's a veil called an eye, and they both work at the third and fourth initiations, and then finally face to face, but that's only one initiator, and on they go in an ever more revealed, unveiled condition. So our work tonight, and all these nights, or mornings, whatever it is for you, to focus together as a group instrument using the creative imagination and the triple light and the power of the will and the occult technique, very simple in some ways, but to be followed quite closely, of dissipating at least some of the veils on the astral plane. The real assault against glamour, I suspect it will be after the Christ reappears, and I suspect it will involve the new group of world servers and the planet Vulcan and the sign Taurus, and maybe a few hundred years from now, but we have to begin somewhere. So we're going to work together. Okay. Then the last time we took a look at how to see the dweller on the threshold of the different initiations. Very, very interesting section, and realizing that dweller somehow is involved even at the fifth initiation, where a great merging occurs, but maybe a kind of a Maya Virupa is involved there. The last line that leads us into our present reading is: the whole process of evolution is initiatory in character, leading from one expansion of consciousness to another, until the worlds of the formless and of form stand revealed in the light which the initiate generates and in which he walks. Those are not just lovely euphonious words. I'll tell you a little story about that as I have come to understand it. And what is this this initiation? You know, what is this expansion of consciousness? I call it in my own language kind of a retraction of the monad in extension. Personality is the monad, soul is the monad, it's all the monad in different states of encapsulation and self-imposed limitation. So this initiatory process is what I call the retraction of the monad in extension, and that monad is itself but an extension of a still greater monad, and on it goes until the one monad is reached, at least in the universe, and that is the being of the universal logos as I understand it. Now, when it comes to the light which we had better learn to generate and in which we walk, little story about that. You know, the Egyptian mysteries, of which masonry is now an important reflection, well, they didn't fool around, you know. It was a life or death process, and it was not the way it is today. You just pass through the initiation casually, and maybe you learn something, maybe you don't, and on you go in the degrees. In those days, you were thrown into total darkness in a space filled with crocodiles. The Nile crocodile, you know, even today is responsible for many fatalities. And if you could not generate from your own Ajna center the light with which to see and in which to walk and to see, I'm afraid you were dinner. So, you know, they didn't fool around there, and it's a real thing that this light in the head has to become a focused beam of real light, which reveals, whether there is substantial light or not, the nature of the forms around which you are surrounded. By which you are surrounded. So we're talking about light, and there's all different ways of considering light. You know, the scientists The true occultists, as he says, on the fifth ray are really discovering what it is. Maybe I have a few more, you know, philosophical kind of ideas about it, and I'm sure you have your own ideas about light. So we're dealing first with the light of matter itself, found in every atom of substance, and that is what we can call the dark light. The dark light of associated with the sign Cancer. The dark light of Cancer, and this is the light of that kind of inherited congestion from the previous solar system, which is very dense indeed, but which can, through the power of Vulcan, be raised to a degree of luminosity in which we will all shine. So every atom has its light potential and must become radiant, and we must be able to appear and disappear at will according to our control of that kind of substance. Then there is the light of the vital or etheric body, he says, a light which is the reflection of the one light, because it unifies the three types of light within the three worlds. Well, this etheric light is really a reflection of the one light of the monad, which is the reflection of the unfettered light of Shambhala. It's the three in one. And the light of substance, the light of the astral plane, the light of the mind, all of these three are unified within the etheric body. And I suspect that the master, by looking at the condition of your etheric body and its general energy flows and the relative development of the centers in your etheric body, can determine what type of monad you are, first, second, or third, or maybe all seven. So it's a very interesting idea that the etheric is the container of a number of different kinds of light, and in the early days of evolution, it's only the physical light, and later, astral light is added, although it's not a real light in terms of reality. We'll learn more about that as we go along. And then the light of the mind, those three lights, particularly, and later, of course, higher types of light, also expressed through the etheric vehicle. Then there is the light of instinct. He's giving us the various types of revelation. These lights are varied and variously revealing. What do they show, you know? The light of instinct, the moon is the ruler of instinct. It involves habit. And, you know, when you think about instinct, what is it really? Because it is intelligent, and yet the people or the animals or whatever who respond through instinct are not aware of that intelligence. So it's really the light of a greater being working through a lesser being or group of lesser beings who is or who are unconscious of that intelligence. You know, you sometimes see the birds in their V formation, and you know the geometry of the flocks of birds and other types of animals, the school of fish and so forth, and they all move with a certain intelligence, and it's guided by higher types of beings who are under the director of an entire kingdom, you know, the lord of the animal kingdom, the lord of the vegetable kingdom, and so forth. So instinct is intelligent, but it's not conscious. And then sometimes we call instinct that which was once conscious, but has fallen down into an area where it is ignored but effective. You know, when you drive a car, you don't think about shifting it every moment, and you don't think about putting on your turn indicator and all that. It's all automatic. Once it was a very conscious thing you had to do, later, to save time and energy, it becomes an automaticism. So all of our spiritual advancement is based upon good spiritual habits or is inhibited by bad habits in a spiritual sense. Then here we have where Alice Bailey began with her book, From Intellect to Intuition. So the light of the intellect or the light of knowledge, and this is largely the lower concrete mind. There is all kinds of knowledge, of course, on the higher planes, but here we're talking about the lower four subplanes of the mental plane, and in order really to be a disciple, we certainly have to cultivate this type of light. We cannot go in the strictly emotional, aspirational mode, but we cannot forget them either. they are important, and DK often tells us that we have to reclaim these things and use them, because the aspirational approach, the heart approach, etc., are very necessary in our quest. Then comes the light of the soul, and you know, sometimes he said the soul is light. Actually, the soul is a special type of light. So sometimes soul and light are considered to be equivalent, and we have kind of an equation here that soul equals consciousness equals light. And we really are, at our stage, seeking to invoke or come in contact with the light of the soul and to bring it into our personal manifestation. And the person who meditates can do this. The person who serves with clear and pure intent can do this. It is a light that is always hovering, so to speak, above or within, and we do learn to access it, and without this, we cannot be involved in the dissipation of glamour. Another light, he keeps on, you know, adding lights upon lights, the light of the intuition. Well, it's many things, and it, you know, it relates to the fourth subplane here. In the beginning, it relates to the fourth subplane, but I have a feeling that the intuition is a much greater thing, and you can even go, you know, to cosmic planes, and, you know, you're going to find the cosmic intuitive plane, you know, and on it will go in all the 10 planes of cosmos. So intuition is not just limited to what we as human beings access on the cosmic physical plane. There are other lights, and I've just written a couple of things here. Intuition reveals unity, you know, and unity on the Buddhic plane is a reflection of the archetypal world of the fixed design, and that archetypal world is found on the monadic plane, it's found on the logoic plane. That's where the real design of God, the planetary logos, for the cosmic physical plane, for his expression upon the cosmic physical plane, that's where it's found, and everything else is really a reflection. So when we look at other lights, I have some ideas here, and maybe you can relate to them or not, you know, you'll have your own. Light is consciousness, and then light is consciousness of the not-self. Light is self-sight, or self-registration. I said these would be kind of philosophical ideas about what the nature of light is. Light is the registration of self as an object. And it's not always that way, you know. There are states in which there is no object, and then there's no need for light at all. In universe, light is self-consciousness. One could meditate on any of this. Notice that I capitalized the word S for self. I'm talking about the universal logos here. I'm not just talking about our own little selves. Light is self-sensitivity. Light is a departure from pure being. Light is an infinite departure from absolute homogeneity or substance. I realize, you know, all of these would take a lot of pondering, and maybe I can just, you know, kind of send this to you, and, you know, you can ponder it if you like. Self-sensitivity, I'm talking again about the great logos, universal logos. Self-sensitivity reveals self-content. And the revelation is, each revelation of a particular content is a specific kind of light. So, you know, this is a departure from the usual ways of considering light as the scientist considers it. It's a form of consciousness. It's a form of self-consciousness. There's really nothing else but the one self, at least in my view. And when that one self is registered, that registration is light. And it is consciousness that registers self. There is a state that Madame Blavatsky calls unconscious, and the great breath knows itself not, and all of that to me is pure being without the need of consciousness. Now, we could debate long and hard about, you know, whether consciousness and light, for that matter, whether they are derivative. of something still more pure and essential. I believe they are, but of course we could work on that thought. Anyway, we're learning about the different types of light, and to keep it simple, DK says, from light to light we pass, from revelation to revelation, until we pass out of the realm of light into the realm of life, which is, as yet to us, pure darkness. In other words, the light is so intense, like the light of Shambhala, and, you know, beyond and beyond and beyond, any very much more intense light cannot be registered by our apparatus, and so we just, it's just darkness, and we don't see anything. But the old saying is, in that light we shall see light, so whatever new form of light we manage to register, it will always reveal a still more intense form of light of which we have been unaware. And, you know, the whole idea is that light is matter, and that's pretty well been proved in atomic physics right now. So, but until the one great being becomes conscious of itself, and that's a special act of minimization, if I can call it that, there will be no light, there will be no universe, there will be no matter, there will only be the one essential universal being, but then he operates within himself, within itself, and light is produced by that self-division, which allows him to register through consciousness his own content, its own content. I realize these are abstract notions, and with any one of them, it would be well to stop and just ponder this whole thing and work out our terminology. But light is a great, great mystery. And, you know, light is basically the substance of the universe itself. And then, of course, the idea is there's a great creator who works in light and who reveals itself through light, and every revelation is part of the creation. So self-revelation is the creation. Self-revelation of the universal God creates the universe through the process of self-becoming. You know, and these are just words at first, but, you know, when we really ponder on them, it is one way of understanding how all this arrived here. You know, it's self-becoming. And we are the very thing we see. So it's a kind of a universal pantheism, if you will, and HPB has many good things to say about pantheism, that the God is everywhere, the universal God is everywhere. And I'm not talking about the absolute now, I'm talking about the universal Logos, who is still a limited being, but it is everywhere, and the old mystics say, you know, break the branch and I am there. Okay, going on a little bit here. Sorry for that philosophical diversion. But, you know, the moon is in Sagittarius for a little while longer, so I'm allowed to do that. Okay, it will be obvious to you that this increasing light brings with it a constantly developing series of revelations, which, like all else in the world of human experience, unfolds before the eyes. First of all, the world of forms. Now, the eyes. Now, you know, let's be clear about that. Unfold before the eyes. It's any of the senses. The eyes represent any of the senses. The sense of hearing, the sense of touch, the sense of sight, the sense of smell, the sense of taste. That's all the eye. The registering mechanism is the eye. So it unfolds before the eyes, broadly, the organs of sense, first of all, the world of forms. And then the world of ideals. You know, we seem to be going into the higher types of worlds. Idealism is found on the second plane of the astral plane, but it could be even a higher thing, because even on the atomic plane, idealism is considered a very high state of revelation. But he holds it below the nature of soul. So the world of the higher mental plane and soul is revealed, then the world of ideas. Now, the world of ideas, pretty much, we're dealing with the Buddhic plane, and maybe to a degree the Atmic plane. So we're already into the cosmic ethers in terms of these revelations. You know what I mean by the cosmic ethers? I mean these four. These are the cosmic ethers, and once we enter the world of ideas, we are there. And then the world of divinity, and you know, basically he's telling us that when we're dealing with divinity, it's always the sixth and seventh plane, counting from below, that is the world of divinity. Everything else is relatively concrete. The five Brahmic worlds are below the world of divinity. So obviously revelation continues, and this is the whole initiatory process, and the more that is revealed, the less we are likely to be taken in by those veils, which are not really true, but which are very actual, very present to our consciousness, and very misleading. You know, like, you know, we can be talking to all the masters at once and writing in purple ink everything they say, and it seems very real to us, but it's really an illusion. So, you know, the progression is very important, and on it goes, and here we're just stopping at the monadic and logoic plane, but on and on and on it goes. How many dimensions are there in cosmos? Master DK says there are 10 dimensions in cosmos. I think it's on page 1084 of Cosmic Fire, right around there from the old commentary, and it just gives you the idea of our cosmic plane and super cosmic and super super and on and on until the 10 dimensions are fulfilled. So we have a long way to go as little emanations, and it will be interesting as group consciousness allows us to be more than just the little individual self we think we are. And that will help us overcome a lot of glamour anyway. So he says, I am choosing but a few of the words which embody the revelation and are symbolic of its character. Now, all of us want revelation. We all want to see the truth. We don't want to be deluded. We don't want to be beguiled. We don't want to take the unreal for the real, you know, lead us from the unreal to the real, lead us from darkness to light, from the unreal to the real, and thus from death to immortality, and on it goes, from chaos to beauty, and from the individual to the universal. Those are the five lead us important statements. We all want that, and we should all train ourselves in such a manner, ongoingly through the centuries, that these things can become real to us, and we will no longer be deluded, emanated consciousnesses in a darkened room and subject to our own limitation. But all these revelations, and I'm calling these the sensitive touching of the contents of self. All there is self, at least in my view. In a universe, all there is self. It depends on how you define self, okay. But anyway, the sensitive touching of the contents of self are revelations, ever more refined contents of self, constitute one great unified revelation which is slowly unfolding before the eyes of humanity. Slowly, slowly unfolding. And our next big unfoldment is to become, as humanity, initiate of the first degree, where we will begin to see the soul in all things and, you know, feel the energy of love, because love is the great revealer. The light of the personal lower self reveals to man the world of form. And most people are caught right there, thinking that's all there is of matter, of instinct, of desire, and of mind. That's as high as it goes. And contemporary psychology pretty much has been revealing that particular world. Form, matter and form are not the same thing, of course. Matter is more substantial, and form requires the second aspect of divinity to geometrize matter and build it into form. But the world of our promptings from whatever vehicle we have, and the world of our desire for those forms and for ever higher states, and finally the world of mind, okay. The light of the soul reveals the nature of the relation of these forms of life to the world of the formless and of conflict, and of the conflict between the real and the unreal. I hope we're all engaged in that conflict between the real and the unreal. And, you know, whenever you're talking about the relation of the forms to life, I call it the world of meaning, because the soul is the world of meaning, and the soul is, in a way, the relationship between the forms and the higher state, the higher formless states, which are more real. So, you know, as aspirants and disciples, we are entering the world of meaning, which is the world which interprets the nature of relationship and sees the degree, if we have spiritual discernment, reveals the degree to which these relationships reflect the archetype or do not reflect the archetype. So when we know when things are put together in a good way, they reflect heaven. Heaven comes to earth, and that's Uranus, the planet Uranus. But when they're put together in a bad way, then the reflection is not there, and the world of becoming does not reflect the world of being. And that's what we have to learn how to do. The light of the intuition unfolds before the vision of the soul within the personality. That's interesting wording. The nature of God and the unity of the whole. So the intuition reveals the whole, all these different stages of higher intuition, and there is no my soul or thy soul, only one soul, and the macrocosmic whole is all there is, we learn in Rule 5 of the Rays of Initiation. So the intuition has to reveal that, the unity of the whole. And the unity of the whole is a great revelation, but there's also what we might call the oneness of the whole, the identicality of the whole, the same substance of the whole, and that is a monadic revelation. But first, unity. Unity is very good, you know. What do they say? Synthesis is, and unity has to be created. I always misquote it, but it's pretty close. Synthesis is, and unity must be created. The restlessness of the material nature, seeking its satisfaction in the three worlds, eventually gives place, now that's the ordinary man, right, ordinary human being, eventually gives place to aspiration towards soul contact and soul life. This is going to happen in your second tier of petals in your egoic lotus. You're going to have aspiration towards some, your higher self, or call it a higher power, or whatever you want to call it. It's part of the spiritual duality which you recognize yourself to be. So it gives place to restless man, you know, the greedy goat seeking satisfaction in the three worlds. Finally, is this all there is? You know, many people, they like commit suicide. They've reached the top of the mountain. Is this all there is? Okay, but there is something else. Eventually gives place to aspiration towards soul contact and soul life. This, in its turn, is recognized as a step towards those great fundamental experiences to which we give the names of the five major initiations. And, you know, in the fifth petal, as that is unfolding, you could become, you know, just a really dominant individual, or you could become an aspirant. And by the time the fifth petal of the egoic lotus is completely unfolded, you have taken the first initiation, the birth of the Christ in the heart, and on it goes with the unfoldment of the other petals. These initiations, the five major ones, I suppose what he means by that is not 3 to 7. He really means 1 to 5, and then there are the higher initiations, including 6 and 7. These reveal to man the hitherto unrealized fact of his non-separateness. Now, that's what we're meditating on, you know, as we do this dissipation of glamour work. That's Buddhic, and of the relation of the individual will, his individual will, to the divine will, which is a combination of atmic and monadic. So, you know, eventually the five initiations will lead to monadic awareness, and if we want to go a little beyond that, by the time we reach the sixth initiation, we will be truly monads, and by the seventh initiation, we will be what is called liberated monads. Okay, well, I get talking here, and I'm not even sure. Yeah, okay. You know, that's probably as much as I can. Well, you know, I'm going to go a little further, if you don't mind. We are now going to study the mode whereby these phases work upon the astral plane are carried forward. Okay. First, the individual learns to use the light of the mind. We're all learning how to do that, if we would only think clearly, generated by the soul. See, the light of the mind, really, you know, the solar angel has stimulated the mind at the process of individualization, in one way or another, you know, sometimes by being there and sometimes just by stimulating it. So the light of the mind has been stimulated in the animal man, generated by the soul as it becomes closely related to the personality, and impulse by this intuition. So basically what we have is intuition, soul, mind. Okay. By means of this light, the disciple learns to dissipate his personal and private glamours. I wonder if the word private means that you think nobody sees them. But of course, you know, I guess our glamours are obvious to everyone but ourselves. By means of this light, the disciple learns to dissipate his personal and private glamours. I mention this because I would have you appreciate the extent of the task a man undertakes when he consciously sets about ridding himself of glamour preparatory to extended service. You know, the old saying, let me be useful, Master DK, and he says, well, what makes you so sure you're useful? So we get rid of our, ridding ourselves of the glamours preparatory to extended service. He is in conflict then with the whole glamour of the entire plane, the astral plane, and is apt to be overwhelmed by a realization of what he is facing. You know, it's just like a tidal wave. You realize, oh my God, you know, what is this? I thought I was just going into something where I could serve, and it's just overwhelming. This is one of the causes of the deep depression and those profound inferiority complexes which render some people completely futile or lead eventually to suicide. And I'm afraid, you know, those upon the second ray and the sixth ray who are really working in the field of glamour and are very, very sensitive are particularly prone to this type of inferiority complex. He really mentions it in relation to the second ray as a natural state. And when the sixth ray type becomes deglamorized or disillusioned, the effect is oftentimes to fall into a depression. With the fourth ray type, you know, depression one minute, exaltation the next minute, so it's an up and down experience. Their own personal glamours tie them in to national or planetary glamour, and thus condition their life expression and their thinking. So, you know, we're not independent of everything that's going on around us, especially these days. My gosh, think of Germany and the national glamour thing. I mean, all these nations, the U.S. right now, there's plenty of glamour running around there, too, with a sixth-ray personality. I would ask you to remember this as you deal with people, because, you know, people like ourselves will deal with people. We have to help in the enlightenment and find them set in their ideas and unable to see the truth as you see it. They are as they are because their individual glamour is fed by the greater glamours, and this is as yet too much for them. And that kind of takes you right back to the whole idea of how it was in the early days when the Black Lodge decided humanity is getting too close right now to some kind of initiatory state or some kind of revelation, and they deliberately fed the glamours. So we have to be careful of the kinds of forces that want to feed the very glamours which we are trying to be rid of. So this is the end of Doggy. I like that because, you know, it's all about Sirius and the sixth ray and following things. End of Doggy reading. Whoops. I don't know where I just was there, but there we go. Reading, number 18, and this day is the 7th of October, 16, and, you know, we'll thank you for responding tonight. You know, as I say, we had this the family event. There was a death in the family, and, you know, when you have funerals and things of that nature, you know, to his mother passed on, and it's just impossible to keep a real schedule exactly. So, you know, this maybe should have been, at first I said a morning time, then an evening time. Anyway, thanks for responding, and thanks for being here. All right, now I'll make this small, if I can. There's lots to think about here, and of course we have to both think and we have to meditate. Some people have said, well, what is meditation? It's not what you think, but I don't know if that's exactly true. All right. So there's so many different ways to meditate, and we're learning about them. And, okay, so now let me make this very, very small and see what we can do. Yeah, that's not too bad. Okay, just take me a moment and forgive this little bit of housekeeping here. And maybe we'll be able to look at some of the things we've been thinking about and review them, and then get into our important work, which is, of course, our meditation on group glamour. However, I just want to say this, that the more you actually know about the subject, this is where knowledge actually feeds your ability to meditate. So let's not think, oh, I want to meditate, I don't want to think. I don't want to, you know, I don't care if I have this kind of knowledge or not. The knowledge is definitely important. Okay, there we go. All right, friends. Now, if anybody has any thoughts you would like to share, any questions, whether on this material or on material you've been thinking about in relation to glamour, you are most welcome. You know, just raise your hand, and if I miss you for some reason, then Brett or Joe should be able to catch me up on that. And I'll be happy to give you my impression. I can't say I give you an answer. I can say I can give you an impression, you know, because who knows what is the truth exactly. Okay. Any thoughts that you have on what we've read or something you've been thinking about during the last week about glamour and its dissipation? It's a great, great subject, and relevant to us. Relevant. Okay, anybody? Anybody? Oh, there's a hand. Okay, Olivia, please go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you bet.
Okay. You know, I was thinking about what you were talking about, and so I wanted to mention something that I like to do when I hear things about separativeness, such as someone says, you know, this religion is bad, or this race, or this nationality, and they speak about, you know, how they don't like this group or that group. And I always think of what Master Maurya said, which is don't fight evil, but give energy to the good, and that it will overtake the weeds in the garden. So in responding, and it can be in our thoughts, a lot of times we really don't want to engage if we think someone is really polarized and all activated and juiced up. But it can be with our thoughts or, you know, verbally, if we feel that's appropriate. But this idea of creating something positive, a positive thought that can also be in the world of thought and in the astral plane as well, with emotion, I guess. But certainly. So when I hear that, you know, I will affirm or assert with my thought, you know, we are all one, or quote a teaching or a person who, you know, whatever seems appropriate, I think, to any of us. I mean, of course, a favorite of mine is the Dalai Lama when he says we are all the same. So it seems almost like helping to create something good and positive that can potentially help offset negative thoughts, creating some positive thoughts, being out there in that field too, affirming them and asserting that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wisdom to that. The basically, you know, if we go into the light of the soul, Patanjali Sutras, he basically says that when thoughts contrary to yoga arise, assert thoughts that are contrary to the contrary thoughts. When I think about the area of human health, you know, just to bring it down to a very concrete level, I think to strengthen the immune system, which is, you know, I think analogous to positivity, is the very, very best way. And so, you know, that the defenses of the organism itself will beat back the disease. And occasionally when, you know, very drastic circumstances arise, such as did during the war, then you have, you know, then you need surgery or something. I think the first choice is to strengthen the good. And he tells us that There's a, you know, you might be interested. There's a place here in the book, The Rays and the Initiations. I think it's on page 506 or 507, right in there. Let's see if I am I doing it. Oh, there it is. Okay, so this tells us something about our soul quest. And he says here, the preservation of values is the task of the initiate of the first ray, you know, and sometimes some pretty rough methods are needed. However, for the second ray, the attainment of positivity is the goal of the initiate of the second ray. And it goes on here, page 507 and so forth. So we see the method that is used for the people who are really initiates and who have built the Antikarana, and positivity is a huge thing. And yet we had Master DK basically saying, okay, the Allies, I'm you know, back in World War II here, the Allies must seek the unconditional surrender of the forces who represented the Black Lodge. So, you know, we had some very drastic things going on there, but he counseled first in 1936. He said, look, you have a chance here. Just stimulate world goodwill tremendously, and there is a chance that we can avoid what is imminent in this situation if it's left untreated. So that would be the way to operate first, and I think that, you know, you're right about that, and we should go in that direction. And later, you know, hopefully we can avoid the, you know, the very heavy things that are involved in the great conflicts of the world. Anyway, thank you. Thank you, Libby. Other thoughts or other thoughts about this reading, about, you know, the subject in general? Anybody, or on staff, if you will, if you wish. Yeah, wait. Okay, Karen, hold on. There we go. Okay, Karen, go ahead. Now you have to unmute yourself, Karen. There you go.
So now you can hear me?
Yes, you bet.
Okay, I'm asking for some clarification about the sign of the cross that we make.
Yeah.
And, you know, the difference between, you know, the cross of matter and the cross of divinity, one being more elongated than the other. And, yeah. And then also, how does that relate, or does it, to, you know, the Aquarian cross, which is an equal-armed cross?
Well, you know, sometimes we try to avoid this long-armed cross because we think it's so related to the sixth ray, but the interesting thing it is, and so many of the workers in this field must exactly be on the sixth ray or have a strong sixth ray component. The Aquarian cross is somehow a real balance between spirit and matter, which has not yet been achieved in our civilization. So we're going to be working towards that. But let's take a look at what he says here. This is page 230. As they say this, each person in the group makes the sign of the cross by touching the center of the forehead, the center of the chest, and each of the two eyes, thus forming the long-limbed cross of the Christ or divine humanity. Now, that's very interesting, not just the six-ray cross. We have to remember that the number six is related directly to the monad, which is on the sixth plane, and has all of this Lord of ceaseless persevering devotion. So it's a higher way of interpreting this long-arm cross. The cross is not, as you well know, simply a Christian symbol. It is the great symbol of light and of consciousness, and signifies the vertical light and the horizontal light, the power of attraction and the power of radiation, soul life and service. You know, obviously in the Aquarian age, much more radiation and service is going to go forth. The cross, as now made in the Catholic Church, touching the forehead, the heart, and the two shoulders, is the sign of matter. This is interesting. I mean, you know, why should that be so exactly? The eyes are not involved. Consciousness is not involved, interestingly. It signifies, in reality, the third aspect. The cross which the group will make is the cross of Christ and of the Christ consciousness. gradually the cross of Christ, the cross of the risen Christ, will supersede the cross of matter and of the mother aspect. You know, because we know the Catholic Church, interestingly enough, has a third-ray personality and, you know, other sixth-ray factors, but its third-ray personality is the major problem. So eventually, this cross of the Christ, as he calls it, will supersede the cross of matter and of the mother aspect. Its likeness to the swastika is obvious and will be one of the reasons for its disappearance. So, you know, the way that the normal Catholic cross is made is said by him to represent the swastika. And here, the long-arm cross is supposed to somehow bring us very much in touch with the Christ consciousness on the monadic plane at this time. Eventually, I think that the Aquarian cross, which is the equal arm cross, we don't know exactly how we're going to make that within our, you know, apparatus, will supersede all of these when service and soul are in a balanced condition. So he gives a kind of a higher dignity to this long arm cross than we are usually used to thinking about. And this is what he says about it, so, you know, we have to somehow take it from there. What do you think?
Okay. I was just thinking in terms, when you actually make the cross, you know, how much longer armed is it?
Well, it goes to the center of the chest, not to the heart. It goes from the forehead to the center of the chest, and then one eye, and then the other eye. So it's really, the verticality of it is very great. The spirituality is very great. But it's higher than just the aspirational sixth-ray cross. He relates it directly to the Christ, and I think to Christ on the monadic plane, sitting at the right hand of the Father. And I think what has to happen is that this cross, it has to grow its horizontal arm, as we learn how under the seventh ray in the age of Aquarius, to really radiate in service whatever we touch along this higher line.
Or
I know there are some ambiguities here. I know there are ambiguities here. But,
wow.
But,
well, that's helpful. I've just been, you know, I've just wondered about that. Thank you.
Yeah. Me too. I wonder about it because it's such a... Sometimes he says, well, now we have to go to the Aquarian cross because the long vertical arm is of the sixth ray. But we have to realize that the monad, as a lord of ceaseless persevering devotion, where the Christ sits at the right hand of the Father, is also of the sixth ray. So, you know, that's how I spiral the thing up and make sense out of it, at least for me.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Karen. Okay, friends, what shall it be? Okay, Suzanne Miller, looks like a question here. Can you discuss the reference to the swastika? Well, the swastika is an involutionary whirling of the cross, and it just basically represents the descent of spirit into matter, and it exalts the importance of matter, and it was seized upon by, you know, the negative forces somehow to pin the spiritual factors into the form. He said that if Nazism had really won, it would have produced the most materialistic civilization we've ever seen. So it's not a, you know, you can use a swastika which is revolving down into matter, and you can use a swastika which is rising up out of matter. And the one that they used was the one that was involutionary in its nature. There's nothing wrong with the swastika. It's all part of the involutionary and evolutionary process. But the way it was seized upon to kind of anchor and imprison, you might say, it's like the use of the word amen. He says it's like a strong wind that pins you back against a wall. It's a very materialistic affirmation. And he says use the om instead. So they just seized upon one part of this dual process of the swastika, meant to pin the consciousness down into form and make everything a materialistic assessment. But basically it's a divine symbol, and it has to do with the whole creative process, the descent and ascent. It has to do with both. Anything else there, Suzanne? Anyway, that's the best I can do about it, I think, for the moment, you know. There's nothing wrong with that symbol. But, you know, like he said, it's been used in a certain way which will probably make its use in the future very problematic. Just the way the Nazi salute, which is basically the will salute. It's basically an affirmation of the will with the right hand extended. For a long time, you know, you're not going to be able to use it because of all the old associations. Though, you know, in some of the different lodges and internal orders, they still quite use that completely separated from materialistic intention. It's the right hand raised, and it does, despite interpretations which are very materialistic and even sexual interpretations, it is a great assertion of the first ray will to divine power. So you know, the Black Lodge would like nothing more than to grab a hold of some of these really good symbols and pervert them and corrupt them so humanity cannot use them. But gradually we will outgrow that corruption. Okay. Other thoughts? Let's see, what have we got here? Okay, Suzanne was there. Other thoughts, friends, other thoughts or statements that you would like to ask or state or whatever? You know, it's a great book, and you know, we'll just learn a lot by our persistence in thinking about these things together, and then, of course, meditating together. That's what we'll do, and growth will be inevitable, and the world really needs it right now because we're making big decisions, you know, like Libra is growing very strong in the planetary horoscope. Okay, well, that's nice because it's the brings in the spirit of peace, and it brings in the Prince of Peace, which is the Christ, and, you know, many wonderful things, but it also brings in, I come to bring not peace, but the sword. Okay, the sword of discrimination, and we people, you know, on our way, will have to make some decisions along the right line in order to avail ourselves of the higher potentials of the incoming Libran energy. So, you know, you say this life is very important. What you decide now is really, really important for yourself, for your group, and humanity is making huge decisions right now. And will these decisions lead to hundreds of years of delay or even thousands, or will they open the door into the Aquarian age in the right way? Because don't forget, energy is impersonal, so you go into the age of Aquarius, and you that energy can be used in ways which are extremely destructive and spread destruction and epidemics and sickness and, you know, all kinds of stuff if we don't do it right. So your decisions now are very important, and I'm sure we realize that. Well, if there is not any other need to go further with it right now, then let's get into our meditation. Yeah, we certainly should, given the timing. All right, so we know this meditation by now pretty well. And the idea is that we are one unit, a consecrated unit. We are aspirants and disciples striving to be useful in the world situation. And we adhere to the simplicity of this meditation. Later on, we'll be reading, and Master DK says, well, please do what I say, you know. I give you meditation, please follow it. It's amazing how many people really didn't want to do that. But okay. So here we all are, some 33 or 34 of us, and all working together, and although we appear to be separated in form, in consciousness, we are together. So we'll have, if not 10 minutes of silence, we will have some silence as we think of our purpose and our objectives. And we'll allow the silence to bring about a necessary group fusion. So in the silence, then. Then we will use a protective formula as if we need it, and we do need it. And you can use the kind of cross we've been talking about, 2 points in the first sentence, the left eye in the second sentence, and the right eye in the third sentence. As a soul, I work in light, and darkness cannot touch me. I take my stand within the light. I work, and from that point, I never move. Calls it the cross of divinity, and we should remember this powerful occult statement. I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men to me. Then we work in the dual light, we focus the dual light of matter, particularly etheric physical, the dark light to become a brighter light, and of mind, the light of matter and of ether, and the light of mind, drawn up onto the plane of mind. Which means we can think and we know what we're doing. We know why we're doing it and we have the energy to do it. Then we meditate on soul contact and the recognition of soul light. And the blending of these three, matter, mind, and soul light, occurs on the mental plane. We imagine the fusion of the three lights. Having imagined this, we say together, the light is one, and in that light shall we see light. This is the light that turns the darkness into day. And at this point, we remember that the light of day is the particular light associated with Scorpio and the Buddhic plane and with the entire human hierarchy of monads all together. Hercules, conquering glamour and illusion, achieved the light of day in which the Hydra died. Then, beginning the formula, we say aloud in our present place, radiance are we and power. We stand forever with our hands stretched out, linking the heavens and the earth, the inner world of meaning and the subtle world glamour. We reach into the light and bring it down to meet the need. We reach into the silent place and bring from thence the gift of understanding. Thus, with the light we work and turn the darkness into day. Thinking of these words, we visualize the great searchlight we have created, that light being turned upon the astral plane. And we know we are accessing energies which can turn the darkness into day. And so that searchlight is visualized out there, in there on the astral plane. And it's a group light now, made of the many individual lights, and it's going to help turn the darkness into day. And now we're going to empower that beam of light with the spiritual will, which comes from the atmic plane, even fed by the divine will of the monadic plane. It descends into the egoic lotus, into the synthesis petals, into the sacrifice petals, into the head center, into the base of the spine. We're going to call upon the spiritual will, empowering our beam And we say, with power upon its beam, the light is focused on the goal. And we feel the empowerment and feel and see inwardly the light focused upon the goal. Now we become specific with these words of power, visualizing and working as we say them. The power of our united light prevents the appearance of the glamour of hatred and separativeness. The power of our united light negates the quality of the glamour from affecting humanity. The power of our united light destroys the life behind the glamour, the vitality which keeps it coherent. We will work for 5 minutes in silence and intensity of purpose, visualizing the light, our group beam, penetrating into the glamour and producing its weakening and dissipation. so our group beam does its destructive work, weakening, dissipating the clouds of glamour. The winds of air of the Buddhic plane blow away the clouds. The heat of the sun of unity and love dissipate the clouds, evaporate the clouds. The sun of love and unity and clarity and truth, that sun shines forth, and the veils are weakened and dispersed. So we refocus upon the mental plane. We turn our attention away from the astral plane. And this group searchlight is, for the moment, imaginatively turned off. And to confirm our work together, in the three worlds of Maya, glamour and illusion, where glamour is the strongest of the three, we sound together the Om three times. So, friends, we will continue this work. As DK says, well, it may have to be for a while. Even years, he says. Okay. Whatever's necessary. Inside the dialogue box, I think you have the Ask Comprehensive link. Tomorrow morning, because we have this very full weekend, but we'll do this in the morning, and a short meditation on the well, it would be the destiny of the nations, but it'll focus particularly on places of great crisis, Aleppo, you know, in Syria, where there is so much destruction and the humanitarian crisis of the migrants, you know, is being used also as an opportunity to infiltrate. We know that too, but there are so many people that are, you know, in dire conditions, shivering, cold, without adequate food, exposure, drowning, bombed. You know, it's all part of this great heresy of hatred and separateness or separativeness. So we'll have a brief meditation trying to bring aid, succor, some sort of relief, some sort of hope to people who are looking for a better life, and they, you know, are often shut out, and we don't necessarily have to agree with everything they think, but just from the humanitarian point of view, there is a crisis, and the kinds of energies we can generate will be helpful, subjectively. So I think inside the chat box, I think that's where we should find that. Yeah, That's where it is. Okay, well, thank you. And then, okay, just to review, so we'll have that brief meditation. It'll have to be brief because we have a schedule here starting at 5 a.m. GMT. Then neither Tuya nor I will be able to do the attracting money for hierarchical purposes on Sunday, but you do that yourself. And like he says, the crux of the whole reappearance problem is the financial one. Amazing thought. We've got to get the third aspect and second aspect of divinity together. And then next week, I think we'll be resuming the morning work on Wednesday, whatever day that is, Wednesday the 12th, with the triangles meditation. And, you know, we're traveling and all that, and we'll let you know what is possible for us. We'll try to just continue things as regularly as we can, except when we're totally on the road and can't do anything about it. So thank you for your presence. Work on your individual glamours and their dissipation and try to see yourself clearly. And we'll have the individual formula, which we will review, and together we do the group formula, and we will proceed over the weeks and months and probably, I suspect, years in trying to clarify the situation on the astral plane, and then also be cognizant of the Maya and illusion problem. So good night, good day, good morning, whatever it is for you, and thank you. And we'll see you, some of you anyway, or however many, tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock here in Finland, 5 o'clock GMT, and we'll have a meditation on the human tragedies which are unfolding. However karmic it may be, you know, we cannot think of it only that way. We must think about the human dimension. Just imagine yourself in those situations of hunger and cold and destruction and rubble, you know, all those things. Just imagine. So we'll try to aid, we'll try to bring aid to those people subjectively. Okay, bye-bye for now. We'll see you. Thank you. Bye-bye.